All right, well, I'm going to begin for Sunday school. And we find ourselves on Sunday, October the 5th, 2014, and it is 10:01 a.m., which means we're late. But that's my fault, because I was sitting here at 10 o'clock, and I could have started talking then. I thank you all for being here. And I hope that you can hear me over the air conditioning or the heating unit, but if you can't, we can turn it off easily enough. I'm going to do Sunday school this month, and then Larry's going to do it next month. And what I'd like to do is, for myself and what I plan to do in the future, is to think about a program of Sunday schools that I will deliver over a period of a couple of months, maybe, or more than a couple of months, starting after Larry does his, and maybe not in December, but maybe in January. And the person I'm thinking about talking about is Immanuel Kant. And one of the reasons I'm reluctant to talk about Immanuel Kant is that a lot of us come from familiarity with, if not enthusiasm for, objectivism. And you may remember the church lady in Saturday Night Live. I think it was the church lady. Well, as far as Ayn Rand is concerned, Kant is Satan! And so I've been reluctant to actually, say we should talk about him. And so I'm going to raise the possibility that we talk about Satan starting in January, perhaps, today. And so what I will do is I'll talk a little bit about Kant's biography simply today. And talk about a little bit about his relationship to beauty today, which we've already talked about some. And then if we have time in the 28 minutes we have remaining to us in this morning, I want to talk a little bit about deep experiences of being alive, which is a subject which came up when I was talking to Madam President about what it is that our group or what moral communities do generally to cause people to want to come, and I'll get into that in a minute. But first I want to talk about and make an argument for a discussion of Immanuel Kant. And I'll mention first that he changed his name from Emmanuel to Immanuel after he learned Hebrew. I don't know why that interested me, but it did. So before I begin full-blown talking about Immanuel Kant, I want to give you a reason why, and I'll talk in the context of my further talks, about why we might want to pay attention to Immanuel Kant. Now, he has a number of observations that he made over the course of his many years of life, which I think we would find in our group appealing. He famously wrote an essay, the essay was called, "What is Enlightenment?" And he answers that question in his essay. And the essence of his definition of the Enlightenment is the Latin phrase, which means dare to be wise. Who can object to that? Who can't embrace that as a wonderful concept? Another idea of Kant's, which I find appealing to some extent, is his categorical imperative. Now, we would immediately react negatively to this concept of a categorical imperative, but the first statement of the categorical imperative, which we happen to be studying in our tapes on Tuesday nights, first and thirds, and that's why this sort of comes to my attention. The first formulation of the categorical imperative is, always act according to that maxim whose universality as a law you can at the same time will. And that's a little bit convoluted, but the gist of it is, do things in accordance with rules that you would make universal. Now, there's another formulation of the categorical imperative. He has four, but we're not going to talk about them all today. I'm just going to talk about this second one, too, total. Is really magnificent, and that, in my opinion, it's my opinion that it's magnificent. The formulation is this. The rational being acts on the basis of maxims of actions that rational beings must be treated never as means, but as the supreme limiting condition in the use. And what this means is that people, rational beings, should never be treated as means, but always as ends. Individual people should be treated not as means to the goal of your action, but as ends of actions. And I'm going to talk a little bit more about that, but I do think it's a marvelous formulation. So, he also talks about beauty and morality and their relationship, which I discovered post my interest in beauty. My interest in beauty came, as you may recall, from our study of Aristotle and Joe Sachs' translation, in which he said the goal of all ethical action is the beautiful. Well, Kant, while not referring to that specifically, embraces the general concept, and that's why I'm interested in Kant in our group. So now I'm going to tell you a little bit about his life so that we can place him in history. He is a German. He was born in Königsberg, Prussia, which is now a city in Russia. He was born in 1724, and he died almost 80 years later in 1804, 2 months before his 80th birthday. Now, in history, he occupies a very interesting point in time because he is a child of the Enlightenment. And during the French Revolution, and the American Revolution, for that matter, occurred during his life. So I said he was born in 1724. 42 years later, in the middle of his life, the American Revolution happened. And then 13 years after that, in 1789, when he would have been 58-ish, the French Revolution happened. Now, my view of history is that the French Revolution, it is defined by and motivated mostly by an intellectual character by the name of Jean-Jacques Rousseau, who we've talked about sometimes. On the other hand, the American Revolution is the founding fathers of the American Revolution, in my view, are people like Adam Smith and John Locke, essentially the Enlightenment. So we have two different features of our modern society, which I would regard as one, the Enlightenment, and two, the Rousseau view of the world, which I should have a label for, but I do not at this moment. And Kant was right in the middle, his life was right in the middle of both of these founding ideas. He was more influenced by the Enlightenment than the ideas of Jean-Jacques Rousseau, although he was entirely interested in Jean-Jacques Rousseau. Some of you may have some acquaintance with Kant and his groundbreaking ideas. He claimed to have been the creator of what he called a Copernican revolution. And this made reference, obviously, to Copernicus and the idea that the Earth versus the Sun, which is the center of the universe, well, if the Earth is, the Copernican Revolution changed the worldview of science to say that the Sun is the center of our solar system. Well, Kant claims to have changed things, too, by suggesting that there's not this objective world out there that we all pay attention to and are aware of, and that's the, you know, our guiding light. He said, no, what's another thing that is important in the functioning of understanding is the what the structures of the human brain are. And so he had the idea that time, the ideas of time, the ideas of space are somehow embedded in the human psyche and consciousness, and this determines the way we look at the outside world. He said, too, that cause and effect are ideas which are within the human mindset, and that they are critical parts of the way we evaluate the world. In other words, he's sort of saying that time and space aren't really out there, they're in here. He's saying that cause and effect aren't out there, they're in here. And so he makes this distinction between, famously, and you probably heard these words, the noumenal world, which would be the world of which one might have direct access, to which one would have direct access, and the phenomenal world, that world which we perceive through the senses. And he famously suggests that we have no access directly to the world. Therefore, we only experience the phenomenal world through our senses. This criticized idea and probably ultimately falls into disfavor for various reasons, but That's just one of his major ideas, and I mention it not because it's of great interest to me, but because it's a major part of who he is. Now, the three major works of Kant, he has many, many essays and writings, but the three that we are all familiar with are the Critique of Pure Reason, which was 1781, the Critique of Practical Reason, 1788, which is 7 years later, and then 2 years later, the Critique of Judgment. And it's the Critique of Judgment that I'm most interested in exploring. The way these three critiques might be analyzed would be that the Critique of Pure Reason deals with the subject of nature. And with respect to the subject of nature, Kant would be a complete determinist, that it's all determined by cause and effect. If nature is determined by cause and effect, and it's not, it's just fixed in that sense. The Critique of Practical Reason deals with the subject of morals. And here is where Kant introduces the idea of free will, and he's a believer in free will, and therefore he would be inclined to say that we can all act morally and are blamable if we don't act morally. And so that deals with the domain of morals. First one was nature, the second one was moral. And the third area is the area of aesthetics, which is what I'm interested in. The area of, and that's in the Critique of Practical Judgment, where he talks about aesthetics and what the theory of aesthetics is as far as he's concerned. Now, Immanuel Kant was not only a philosopher. He did many things, and I wanted to mention three that I thought were very interesting that are outside the domain of philosophy, one might say. He studied the question of the earth and its motion and its revolution. Or is that what it is when it rotates like this? Rotation. And he postulated that the earth is affected by, there's a frictional resistance with respect to the tides that influences the earth's rotation. Now, I think this is commonly accepted as a fact right now, but he was the first one to say that, which is news to me. He postulated and came up with the idea that the solar system was produced from nebula, that is, from a cloud of dust. And, of course, that's sort of my sense of things now. He also said in the same vein, he said that this Milky Way thing we're seeing out there is actually a cluster of stars. So he was the one that originated that idea, according to my secondary sources. And he also said that that big thing, the Milky Way, was likewise formed from a cloud of dust and nebulae as well. So he had some ideas which were, pretty good, which is another reason why we might want to think about looking at him, because maybe he does think clearly and he does good ideas. Now, I mentioned, I think, that he was born in Königsberg, which is in Prussia, now Russia. And at the age of 45, he became a professor of logic and metaphysics at the University of Königsberg. And he didn't do much else for 11 years until 1781, when he wrote this Critique of Pure Reason. And then he had this period of 11 years, which I think the secondary sources suggest that he's sort of lying fallow when he's trying to figure stuff out, and then all of a sudden you have this, what's regarded now as one of the most important works of modern Western philosophy, and that is the Critique of Pure Reason. But there is a critique of the Critique of Pure Reason in that it's incomprehensible. 800 pages long, very poor style, difficult style, who am I to say it's poor? But it became famous because he had a student who wrote a bunch of letters talking about important philosophical issues and referring to the Critique of Pure Reason as his source of ethics. And based upon his student's simple letters referring to the Critique of Pure Reason, it actually became a powerful and important and influential work and is now regarded as one of the great works of the Western philosophical tradition. Now, I don't intend to go there because that's not particularly of interest to me, at least in my Sunday school thing. I'm interested more in the third critique. What's that, Mark?
Kind of deep.
Yeah, it's way too deep for me. It's way too deep for me. So those three critiques are the most important part of his work. It has been said that with respect to the Critique of Judgment, or the aesthetical work, that he is one of the first philosophers to develop and integrate aesthetic theory into a unified philosophic system, which of course is very interesting as well. Now, he did a little bit of work on politics, and this too appeals to me. He was of the opinion that a total majority, that a total democracy, that a pure democracy, that is, everybody voting for everything, was a bad thing. That he thought that that would lead to, that it's a threat to individual liberty. Now, he's talking about pure democracy. He's not talking about the corrupted word we use today, which refers to something else, not quite the same.
Theoretical versus actual working reform.
What he was in favor of was a constitutional republic, which, of course, is what we really have. I mean, that's what we claim to have in America, but it's sort of the system which most people regard as the, well, many people regard as the best system, a constitutional republic. Plus, his politics involved the idea of international organizations. So his politics seemed to me to be worthy of praise. I mean, this is certainly my thought about it, too. Now, I've mentioned that the three critiques deal with three different types of ideas. This first one, pure reason, dealt with nature. The second one deals with morality, and the third one deals with aesthetics, and that takes up the entire space. In the theory of beauty, what he comes up with is that he says that we have this function or this capacity which is called judgment. That's what this first critique is called, the critique of judgment. And the judgment, this faculty of human reason about judgment, is that which enables us to determine what is the beautiful or what is the sublime. He has another faculty or another feature of human beings which he calls genius. And this is what allows an artist to create art that is beautiful. Now, I think this is a very useful, I love this this category of the genius, because it's what he's saying is that, at least the way I interpret the category of the genius, is that he's saying is, you know, I can't put a greater handle on it than to say, here's this black box over here, which I call genius, and out of this black box, which is in somebody's head, you know, pops out art. I mean, he's unable to get under it, which I think is I like that concept, because I don't know who can get under the capacity of Van Gogh to create beautiful art, or who can get under the capacity of Caravaggio to create beautiful art, name the person, Mozart. You know, how does that happen other than by some black box faculty, which the only thing you can do is put the label of genius on it? And so that appeals to me very much. So, that brings me to a couple of quotes that I wanted to read to you with respect to Immanuel Kant that I think are connecting Immanuel Kant to this subject of beauty that I'm interested in talking about. All right. The case is quite different with the beautiful. It would, on the contrary, he's talking about here the difference between an estimate that's a beautiful thing and that other thing pleases me, like I like chocolate. You know, it would be, you know, you wouldn't say chocolate is beautiful. That's what he says here in many words. The case is quite different with the beautiful. It would be, on the contrary, be laughable if a man who imagined anything to his own taste thought to justify it to himself by saying, this object, the house we see, the coat a person wears, the concert we hear, the poem submitted to our judgment, is beautiful for me. In other words, he's criticizing that. You would not say, when you say, Caravaggio created a beautiful piece of art here for me, you say that's not valid. For he must not call it beautiful if it merely pleases him. Many things may have for him charm and pleasantness. No one troubles himself with that. But if he gives out anything as beautiful, he proposes in others the same satisfaction. He judges not merely for himself, but for everyone, and speaks of beauty as if it were the property of things. Hence, he says, the thing is beautiful, and he does not count on the agreement of others with this his judgment of satisfaction, because he has found his agreement several times before, but he demands it of them. He blames them if they judge otherwise, and he denies them taste. That is, if you don't think it's beautiful, you have bad taste. which he nevertheless requires of them. Here then, we cannot say that each man has his own particular taste. For this would be as much to say that there is no taste whatsoever, i.e. no aesthetical judgment, which can make a rightful claim on everyone's assent. Obviously, that's an extremely powerful and strong statement of the beautiful, as distinct from what you find pleasant, what you happen to like. Now, here's a very short one that suggests what I have found interesting in Aristotle. Here's Kant. He says, now I say the beautiful is the symbol of the morally good. Now that's where I want to start running. You know, I'm interested in how that works, because I can see, or think I can see, sometimes I can detect what the beautiful is. And so when I see that kind of comment, I'm thinking that somewhere in this 40 pages of text that I think we're going to look at over a couple of months of Sunday school, he's going to answer that question, because that's really important to me. What is the relationship between the good and the beautiful? And he says it's the symbol of the good. Beautiful is the symbol of the good. And finally, this quote. A reference to this analogy is unusual even in the common understanding of men. And we often describe beautiful objects of nature or art by names that seem to put a moral appreciation at their basis. We call buildings or trees majestic and magnificent, landscapes laughing and gay. Even colors are called innocent, modest, tender, because they excite sensations which have something analogous to the consciousness of the state of mind brought about by moral judgments. Taste makes possible the transition, without any violent leap, from the charm of sense of habitual moral interest, as it represents the imagination in its freedom, as capable of purposeful determination for the understanding, and so teaches us to find in objects of sense a free satisfaction apart from any sense of charm. What he's saying there is that beauty, the terms of beauty are similar to the terms and utilize the terms of the moral and the good, which is part of the reason he thinks that there's a relationship between the beautiful and the good. And that's the core of my interest in looking at Kant, perhaps starting in January and going for a couple of months, when we'll have this text, and I'll give copies of it out so people can, if they choose to, read along with us. So that's my proposal with respect to Kant. I see we have about 7 minutes left, and if somebody has any comments, I'll do that. I'll be happy to hear the comments. But if not, what I would propose in the last 7 minutes is to do a little bit on this thing that I was interested in, the deep experience of being alive as it relates to four. Anybody want to comment, or do you mind the shift? Okay, I'm going to shift. All right, now this comes up, this subject of deep experience of being alive in the context, really honestly, of Sunday Assembly. I'm interested in other groups and how they draw people and how they inspire people, and why people go to various groups, especially moral communities or churches or this group or Atlanta Free Thought Society or things like that. And, you know, I think the most obvious explanation might be something simple like, well, there are a lot of people there that I'm of like mind with them. You know, I like them. They're my age. You know, we have common interests. You know, and that probably is a really good starting point for what's going on. And, you know, that's fine. I mean, that's very interesting, and that's very fine. But I think, you know, maybe there's something beyond that with that very simple explanation, which has at least partial purchase for me. What do you think? Do you think there, Mark, you agree with that?
Well, to some degree, I've found that people who show up at meetings like this, and the AFS and the FFRF meetings, at some point in time, they start doubting their religious convictions or religious beliefs, and that little doubt festers into a full-blown, you know, realization that they've been hoodwinked their entire life. And then they realize that they need to break out and, you know, liberate their mind from it, and they'll show up at one of our meetings.
Right.
And I find sometimes when these people first show up, because I'm on the board of directors of AFS, and I'm one of the founding members of the Freedom for Religious Foundation that meets here. But I always try to talk to these, you know, first-time people, and it's inevitably something along the lines of, you know, they they really, you know, realize that there's a religious dogma and doctrine that they've been adhering to is, you know, no way to live.
Right.
It actually enslaves the mind instead of liberating.
Sure. That's very good.
Yeah.
What I'm trying to get at, though, beyond that idea and beyond the idea of finding people of like mind, is something of a higher order. And the context of this was, religious ecstasy would be in the category that I'm talking about here, and also another concept which I've talked with some of you about, which I've called crowd ecstasy. Now, I'm going to give you a list of 12 things, which includes those two, hoping to put our mind in the category that I'm thinking about. The first one is being in love, and the reason I mention that is because, you know, when you're in love, you know it. And if you haven't been in love, you don't know it. I mean, it's not something you can understand without having experienced that thing. I assume that pregnancy and giving birth is like that. You know, never will I understand what it's like to be
pregnant.
No, and that's going to be outside my possible range. Parental love is going to be like that. You know, parental love is something that only a parent can understand. It's incomprehensible, I think, to a non-parent. The idea of flow, which we've discussed in various contexts, Csikszentmihalyi's idea of what it feels like when you're fully engaged in your task, fully competent and able to deal with it. There's a special feeling that comes as a result of that. One that I thought of was being part of a team. I've only been part of a team, I think, once or twice in my entire life. And it almost has an organic feel to it, those of you who have been a member of a team. I mean, it's really quite an experience, which it was new to me when it happened. It was like a revelation. Okay, now I'm part of a team. This is what this means. The exercise of superpowers, you know, my idea that there's things that we find ourselves capable of doing in a particular circumstance, and, you know, when we can render aid or whatever it might be, doing your thing, that is a very positive feeling which only one can experience when you do it and say, oh, that's what that was. The experience of the beautiful. If you see something that's beautiful and you recognize it as beautiful, there is an experience which is different from, you know, some other category, like, you know, you look at it tastes chocolate, you know, or whatever. You know, there's a special feeling with art and the beautiful which only comes once you are, you can experience that at some point in your life. But we talked about years ago the idea of the oceanic experience, which is strongly related to the beautiful. And a typical way the oceanic experience is evoked, it's done in literature frequently. I did a Sunday school on Roan Stallion, which was Robinson Jeffers' poem, where he has the heroine on top of a mountain, open face mountain in California, with a gorgeous moon, and, you know, she's out there and just has this overwhelming feeling. It's also done in Portrait of an Artist as a Young Man. James Joyce has a scene like that. In Joseph Mann's Joseph and His Brothers, Thomas Mann's book, Joseph and His Brothers, they do that. And interestingly, all three of those are literally at night with the moon out. I mean, it's just sort of almost a banality, because it's so commonly evoked with at night, clear night, like it has been the last couple of nights. And another example, not literature, is in the Celestine Prophecy, they create the oceanic experience in one of the chapters there. And so this is a real thing, which is also interesting. And then the final three are the creation of a perfect work, what it feels like to be creative and then get the thing right and make it. And then the final two, religious ecstasy, which we can see when we watch, happens, I suppose, when snake charmers, or when you go to, you know, you speaking in tongues would be an example of that, or enjoying the playing with snakes in a religious activity. And then the final one would be crowd ecstasy. And the least threatening mode of crowd ecstasy, I think, would be going to a concert and feeling this massive, you know, group feeling with respect to the music that's going on. And this is one that I only experienced once or twice in my entire life. So I'm aware of its existence, but it's not one that I do. And then I've not done religious ecstasy either. But it seems to me that what happens in moral communities, in religious moral communities, is that the big ones are this religious ecstasy and the crowd ecstasy, which may be related. I'm not sure. And the reason, and I think that me, I'm just speaking for myself, but I think this may be an American feature, is that we're all, that Americans generally are suspicious of crowd ecstasy. And the reason we're suspicious of it is because we have an awareness of the Nazis. And we saw in the films from that time period crowd ecstasy, and we saw outcomes which were, you know, very horrible. And so I think Americans, particularly, and probably Germans, are very suspicious of crowd ecstasy.
Oh, Chinese.
Chinese too?
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
Oh, you know, when as I told you at Christmas time, I went to my brother's house because I was in Chicago, and I went to Willow Creek Community Church, the second largest church in the United States, which is a mile from his house. And we went and saw the Christmas program, and it's a 7,500 seat auditorium where people go to hear the minister and see the rock band. And there's smoke machines and lasers, and oh my God, you know, it's a crowd experience. And the rise of the megachurch in the United States suggests that that's not something that people shun, but rather something that people are running towards right now.
Well, I think that there are safe contexts in which you can do crowd ecstasy, right? I mean, the concert, rock concert, is a perfectly good example of where you can go and have crowd ecstasy, and you're not likely to be, you know, massacring babies or something, right? It's not going to be quite as risky there, although, you know, stuff can happen, but it's not very, it's a confined, defined space. And I think this is true in religious environments, too, where, you know, they ask the people in the audience who are infused with the glory of God or whatever it is when, you know, Baptists come from the back of the room and come down there, you know, that's got to be, you know, at least related to crowd ecstasy or religious ecstasy. That is religious ecstasy. It's got to be related to crowd ecstasy too, right? And so that's a confined, it's acceptable expression of crowd ecstasy. Of course, perhaps the worst expression of crowd ecstasy is the lynch mob, right? The lynch mob is a perfect example of crowd ecstasy, but it totally goes bad. So, I bring these things up because, you know, I think moral communities exploit these, and exploits perhaps too bad, it's not the right word, because it's totally pejorative, right? It's to say you're exploiting something is pejorative. But, you know, if I had to identify one of these that we do well would be the exercise of superpowers. You know, because when our members come up and give a speech here and do perform it in whatever way they perform, you know, there's a special feeling associated with that. And one of the things Ron and I have noticed, and maybe others, is that, you know, when somebody comes into our group and does a performance and they experience that feeling, whatever it's defined as, then they will become a member because they had that feeling here. You know, that's sort of what drives many of us to continue coming back, is because we get, you know, the pleasure of exercising your superpowers in this environment. That's a good thing. Experience of the beautiful, something that's fairly safe, oceanic experience. We never accomplish that here, because we don't have a full moon and a blue, beautifully clear night. But you know, and I'm not sure we can do much with religious ecstasy and crowd ecstasy. It's just not who we are. Although I think it's an important part of why other groups. And I'm not saying this of Sunday Assembly. I don't know, but I'm just saying that that's not something we can do. I mean, it's just not who we are. So those are my thoughts about deep experiences of lives. Those are the 12 that I think are very interesting. I do think that to the extent that we are capable of having those experiences, they're worth having, at least for the purpose of education. You know, obviously, pregnancy is out of the realm of possibility for us guys, I suppose. Although technology is always on the move. All right, well, I see we're at the time for an end here. I thank you all for coming. If anybody has any further comments, we'd be delighted to receive them now. If not, yes, sir.
I think that part of our program is always beginning with celebration of freedom. And I didn't see that on your list. And certainly not to take away from the, you know, more from our newest list, but a completely separate set of motivation that drives other groups somewhat like us in many respects is concern over the state of freedom. And the consequences of incursions upon it. And some of those groups that we have, that many of us have a lot in common with, the Mises Institute, for example, very often includes people who are concerned about those issues, who may also, in their own lives, be religious. So there are many in the religious community that many of us would find some common cause with.
Certainly. There's absolutely no question about that. I mean, I feel very brotherly toward most of my religious brethren, so that's not an issue for me. I mean, because there's a lot that goes on. If, you know, for me, of course, as you may know, I'm extraordinarily interested in music through Alexander, and almost all of his interaction with musical people is religious in the context of a religious place and mostly other religious people. So I totally agree with that. No, but there's other things, too, like freedom that you just mentioned. That made me think of one thing that I had omitted, and that is the context of the thing which is doing good things for others, altruism, altruistic acts. A lot of people in other groups, and I remember our friend Christy Gonzalez, was specifically interested in having that be an aspect of our group. Not finding it here, she went and created her own group where that's a major feature. So I didn't want to leave that out as a factor in what moral communities do. And I would think that what we do... Yes, ma'am?
What about a sense of tradition? You know,
what's that?
A lot of atheists, sense of tradition. A lot of atheist Jewish friends who still
want to
stay here for dinners and, you know, cool, and go to their meals and vomits, some people, that's really why they... My mom's Buddhist, goes to the Catholic Church, but she loves the ritual.
Yeah, that's a beautiful idea.
In a sense of, you know, tradition that I guess our group may not be able to offer, I'm sure you can do it in a non-religious way. Actually, that, you know, how many atheists celebrate, you know, winter festival?
There has been some movement, the Second World Coalition of Atlanta group, trying to put together a list of what we call secular settlements, people who can do secular weddings, funerals, and other such things like that, and possibly maybe a few years from now, if we get a group to jail, we can have a winter solstice celebration in lieu of Christmas celebrations, you know, maybe do Saturday or something.
Right.
On the solstice, any number of throughout history, there have been every culture does something around the winter solstice, some kind of a celebration of sorts. And we need to create a set of secular celebrations or festivals and have our secular celebrants to officiate these things. That's something that, you know, as the movement, you know, as our movement grows, maybe we can get more into that.
Absolutely. I love this.
When humans in Georgia were back, they were several attempts to get things like that going.
Valentine's
Day celebrations and things like that were, I can't figure out why it never really gelled.
I'm not sure why that either. AFS has tried to do several Darwin Day things, and we've had some limited success with it, but we're going to try again this February to get
absolutely. Oh, all right. Well, thank you, everyone. And we'll now adjourn for 20 minutes before the big show.
Thank you.